Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The mayor of Seattle denies the allegations. I've been repeating that sentence to you since April, when the Seattle Times first reported claims that Mayor Ed Murray had sexually abused teenaged boys decades ago. Now the Times has told us something new. A child welfare investigator in Oregon concluded in the 1980s that Murray did sexually abuse his foster son. But the county prosecutor in Oregon did not file a criminal charge. Why not? You'll learn about that in 10 minutes. I hope you can stay tuned for that and join us on Twitter now at KUOW. Mayor Murray had a conversation last night, I understand, with my next guest. Jenny Durkin is running to succeed Murray as the mayor of Seattle, and Murray has given her his endorsement. Jenny, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you very much.
I do want to talk about your campaign. I'm sure that's what you came here to talk about, why you should lead the city of Seattle. Since we've just passed on this news, I just want to get your reaction. What was the conversation with Mayor Murray like last night?
You know, first I'll say I've talked to voters all over the city about the future of Seattle, and some people have talked about this issue. I think that I talked to the mayor last night. I told him I was very troubled by the article in the Seattle Times. I know firsthand that foster kids have a really difficult time and are very vulnerable in our society. They are subject to being disbelieved, not credible. Many times they fall into either substance abuse or self-harm. I've represented both victims of sexual assault and people who were wrongly accused of things they didn't do. Both of those people can have their lives torn apart. They're not believed. They're discredited. That's why I believe due process matters so much and why I believe in the courts as a place to get to the truth. I think that these allegations are very troubling. I talked to the mayor and I told him that the next mayor and this mayor, the most important job is to be able to lead the city, to know that you can continue to lead. And I told him that I thought he should reflect very deeply on whether, given these circumstances, he can continue to lead.
Sometimes people in positions of power or running for an office will come out and publicly call for someone to step down. Are you calling on Mayor Murray to step down?
First, I think that no one knows what happened 30 years ago. And I think facts matter. Even if you look at the Seattle Times article that was published yesterday, while they highlighted some of the new documents they saw, they indicated there were over 100 documents that they received. Over my career, I have reviewed literally thousands of police reports and similar government documents in cases like this. And I think the facts matter a lot. So I do not believe any of us are in the position to judge what happened. And what we have to look at is the mayor, who I think has been a good mayor. Again, his job is to make sure that he can continue to lead the city and tackle some of those tough challenges we had and have today. And that's what I asked him to think very deeply about.
I'm talking with Seattle mayoral candidate, former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin. Let's talk about your mayoral campaign. I hear you're the establishment candidate. How do you feel about that?
I think I'm proud that I am the candidate, I think the only candidate that actually has unified a variety of constituencies. I'm supported both by business and by some of the largest labor organizations, including SEIU 775 and the firefighters. I have environmentalist support, and I think as of today, by far, I have the most individual contributors as any candidate. So I think that I'm very proud and pleased that our campaign has garnered such broad support. So I really believe that I am the person who's unifying the city and moving it forward.
Does that mean you're the status quo candidate?
No, I think it would be progress. You know, as you know, I was the first openly gay U.S. attorney that President Obama appointed, first in the history of our country. I've fought for social justice issues for 30 years in the city. And my partner and I, you know, started raising sons 20 years ago. And if we're the establishment, I think a lot of progress has been made.
The Chamber of Commerce endorsed you for mayor. How would you be better for business than the other candidates?
I think that it's a false dichotomy to say someone will be better for business versus better for Seattle. I think in order to move forward, we have to have both business and labor at the table. We need neighborhoods and downtown interest. We have some real critical challenges facing us, including homelessness and affordability. And if we can't move together, we won't build the kind of city that we want for the future.
We asked our listeners on Facebook for their questions for candidates for mayor, and one writer said that Seattle's biggest problem is the rising cost of living and the gap between the rich and poor. The best way to address this is to tax the rich. Are you in favor of the income tax?
I'm in favor of the income tax, but I think the best way to close the gap is to build better economic empowerment throughout our system. We are becoming a system that's not affordable for most people. We are becoming a city that has more rich and more people being displaced. But what we have to do is build jobs for everyone, and we have to do that starting in when kids are in school, have apprenticeship programs. We have an enormous amount of family wage jobs right here in Seattle, everything from building those towers, you know, the laborers who are building them, to filling the towers with the tech workers. But most of those workers are coming from outside the city. I think the best way to change the dynamic in the city is to make sure for the future we have a broader-based economic prosperity.
Why isn't this boom paying for itself in terms of bringing in enough tax revenue that we don't need more and more taxes in Seattle?
I don't think we necessarily need more and more taxes. I think that we need to take a hard look at our budget and scrub it to make sure that the budget that we have is addressing the needs that we have. We clearly need to be spending more and having better policies on affordable housing. Right now, too many people are being locked out of Seattle and can't keep a toehold here. More and more people see their rents rising, and people who've been in homes a long time see their property taxes going up so high they can't stay in them. We need to resolve those issues today.
What would you do about affordable housing that Mayor Murray's not doing?
We have to do a range of things. Number one, because of the HALA bargain, we will have tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to spend on affordable housing. We need to bring it online as quickly as possible in every neighborhood in this city. We also need to be able to have more flexibility so those landlords that are providing good, affordable places to live can keep rents down if we keep their property taxes down. Right now, property taxes go up, the rent gets jacked up, and people get displaced. So we need to do those two things immediately.
So the mayor's HALA committee that's going the right direction, having developers provide some affordable housing, because some people are saying it's not enough. We need impact fees. We need to upzone single family neighborhoods way more than the mayor has stuck with. What do you think?
I think we need to bring all the growth online that we have in the pipeline right now and see how it's working. But we need to hold developers to the bargain. So we need to make sure that we are getting the benefit of the bargain and that the public is getting resources. We have to look at some impact fees, particularly in the area of transportation and parks, I believe. I also think that we've got to look at every neighborhood and figure out how do we grow gracefully. Because every neighborhood is going to get more density. So we have to have deeper conversations with those neighborhoods and parts of town to make sure that as density comes, it's the right kind of density building those neighborhoods of the future.
Well, you said, I'm talking with Jenny Durkin, a candidate for mayor, and you said that you would scrub the city's budget. Would you agree with Natalie, who on Facebook says, Seattle can't seem to manage its own money, revenue at an all-time high, and we keep getting asked for more? Is there irresponsible spending of Seattle money right now?
I don't think anyone looking at the budget knows exactly whether we're getting enough bang for the buck, but we have some indication there's problems. For example, we probably all saw the story where one developer owed the city about $1.5 million for the housing fund that was just never collected. That's too much money to be sitting around on the table. We also have to remember, because we've grown so significantly, city costs go up. And we need to make sure that our core budget will take care of costs. As mayor, I'm going to focus on the basics: potholes, roads, firefighters, police, those things that we need and expect for a city to function.
You know, speaking of transportation, I noticed that when the initiative guru, so-called Tim Iman, basically endorsed you, he was asked, who would you vote for? He said, if I still live in Seattle, I'd vote for Jenny Durkin. And your response was to call him the self-promoting village idiot of Washington State. Why do you say that? And what do you say about Sound Transit, whether they are overcharging people for car tabs?
Look, we shouldn't get diverted on the silly political battles. What we need to do is focus on the future. And if we don't have Sound Transit 3 coming online in the future, our city will creak even further. We absolutely have to improve our transportation system. We have to improve it so that businesses can get their freight and other business things through town. We have to improve it so people aren't sitting in traffic. And we have to improve it so we meet our climate goals. Right now, too much of our carbon is coming from cars. We need to move people out of cars and into other modes of vehicle, whether it's biking, walking, transit, buses. And the only way we do that is to make sure we have a holistic transit system.
Are you saying that the charge that Sound Transit is inflating used car values is a silly political fight?
I'm saying that the focus should not be on the fights of yesterday. I'm saying that we want to, the voters voted overwhelmingly to make an investment in Sound Transit in the future. And they did it with the proposed cost that people saw. I think if they want to revisit how we calculate tabs in the future, it's an absolutely legitimate thing to look at. But what we can't do right now is think that we can cut $2 billion out of Sound Transit and meet any of the mobility or climate goals that we want. What I hear from people everywhere I go is they want an easier way to get from point A to point B. Everyone who knows anything about climate knows that if we don't have a transit system in place in the future, we can't meet the very necessary goals that we have to save our planet.
Talking with Seattle mayoral candidate and former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin, where do you and Ed Murray part ways on policy?
I think there's a range of places that we part ways on policy, and I think anyone who knows the mayor and myself knows we're very different people. We have a different approach to systems and people. For example, look at neighborhoods. You know, he decided that neighborhood councils needed to be eliminated. I've walked in almost every neighborhood in this city now, and what I hear from more people is they don't feel they have a way for their voice to be heard. And I would reinvigorate how we communicate with neighborhoods. I'd have someone in the neighborhood, not try to do it from City Hall. So I think that one critical way is incorporating those neighborhoods. Yes, we have to be equitable. Yes, it has to be open to people of all economic standings, races, and backgrounds. But the way is to increase participation, not to diminish it. Our neighborhoods have long been part of the backbone of our civic fabric, and I think we have to make sure that we're respecting that and using the power of that to move forward into the future.
So what if a neighborhood's voice is heard and that voice says, no duplexes, or no, you know, we don't want your policy, whatever it is. Then what do you do?
I've never heard any community group speak in such litmus test types. I think that's bumper sticker politics is politicians talking. It's not people talking. I've been in gyms, farmers markets, and the like, and everywhere I go, people are willing to be part of the solution. But they also want their voice heard, and I think that's okay.
Jenny Durkin, I think you're the only candidate I've interviewed who's in favor of the city continuing to sweep out unauthorized homeless camps. Is that true, and why do you say that?
First, I think the use of the term sweeps is unfair and wrong. The city has not had what people would describe as a sweep for a very long time. The early relocations were inhumane and cruel, and I would agree that treating people without respect or compassion is the wrong way to go. I volunteered in homeless shelters early in my career on a regular basis and have been out talking to homeless a lot in this campaign and spent 4 hours one night with Union Gospel Mission just going to various encampments and sitting down with the people at Camp Second Chance. I believe that this is a question that tests us as a society. It is both heartbreaking and unacceptable. But I believe that the unsanctioned encampments really are not moral. You know, we spent over $2 million at the beginning of this year just hauling tons of garbage out of the encampments. Tons. The people living there are living in garbage without any resources. There's human waste, needles, rats. When city workers go into the unsanctioned encampments, they're paid extra money because it has been determined it's an unsafe working condition called encampment pay. My question is, why would we let anyone live there? I think it's wrong. So the question is not should they stay in these squalid conditions. The question is, where is our moral authority to create both temporary and long-term housing so people can live somewhere that gives them dignity and respect?
Have you had a conversation with a homeless person in Seattle that you can remember, can relate to us?
Yes. In fact, just last week, I was walking here in the University District and sat down with a number of people and included people who were homeless and talked to them about the reality of living on the streets here in the University District. Some had lived in other places. I spent time last evening just sitting down with the folks in Camp Second Chance, who, as people may not know, it's people who broke into a city property, created their own unsanctioned encampment that is now a sanctioned encampment. And they have a very robust community there where they cook food together. They've managed to bring power in. They're replacing tents with the tiny homes. And it was very enlightening to hear for them what they need. And what I came away with, these are people who deserve respect and compassion, and we have an obligation to get them housing, but also to provide for the other brothers and sisters on the street mental health care counseling and addiction treatment. So many people on the street have a chronic problem with the growing opioid crisis that if we don't deal with that, we will never be helping those people.
Our time is coming to a close with Seattle mayoral candidate Jenny Durkin. Zach wrote on Facebook that Seattle's biggest challenge is addressing its own white supremacy. How racist is Seattle?
Look, our country has a very difficult and tortured history with race. We have to remember when we talk about ourselves being a history of immigrants, for many people, they were not voluntary immigrants. They were brought here in chains and subjugated for generations. That type of subjugation continued, I think, in some regards in the 90s when we attacked the cocaine problem as if it was a criminal justice issue and not a public health issue. And we saw almost an entire generation of men of color incarcerated. We have to be honest about the issues of race. We have to face it honestly, and we have to make sure that when we are dealing with public policy issues, we don't just talk about it in terms of equality. Because equality assumes that everyone starts in the same place. We have to think about it in terms of equity and acknowledge that people do not start in the same place and make sure that we bring people together and provide real opportunities.
Jenny Durkin, those are my questions. What do you want to say finally to KUOW listeners right now?
I think this race is not about who will be mayor for the next 4 years.
It's not?
Nope. I really believe this is about what will Seattle be like for the next generation. We are facing some very critical challenges right now. We talked about some of them here, the issue of homelessness, the issue of affordability, the issue of climate change, and how we build a just and equitable city in the future. More and more people are being displaced from Seattle, more and more people who have to travel into Seattle for work are in low-paying jobs. We, in facing these critical issues, what we decide today really will define what Seattle will be like in the future. I would like to be the mayor that brings people together, that tackles those tough issues, but also seizes the opportunities we have, like developing the waterfront, looking at Seattle Center, and as we build public housing, not think of it as just public low-income housing, but thinking about it as a dynamic part of any neighborhood and community.
Jenny Durkin would like to be Seattle's mayor over the next 4 years and set the city up for the next generation. Jenny Durkin, thank you for coming and talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
More of KUOW's The Record coming right up. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Well, it seemed that the controversy around Seattle Mayor Ed Murray had settled down. He's not running for re-election. His main accuser pulled his lawsuit. Attention had turned to the campaign for the next mayor. But that report from the Seattle Times over the weekend that we were just talking about a few minutes ago, that's turned the spotlight back to Mayor Murray and the original accusations of sex abuse made against him in the early 1980s. KUOW reporter Kate Walters is here to update you. Kate, thank you.
No worries.
What is the latest we know about this report and the allegation against Mayor Murray?
So back in 1984, Murray's teenage foster son, a guy named Jeff Simpson, basically accused Murray of sexually abusing him and paying him for sex. Now, the Seattle Times has published over the weekend documents that were long thought to be lost from child services in Portland, and they show a child welfare investigator in Oregon looked into the Jeff Simpson claims back in the 80s and ultimately concluded that they were true. So on top of that, this particular caseworker goes on to recommend that Murray should never be allowed to be a foster parent again, and he's still not allowed to be a foster parent in the state of Oregon, and that's part of the reason that these documents were kept for 30 years. Murray denied these allegations back in 84. He's continuing to deny them now. He said over the weekend that these new documents don't really change anything, including the fact that he was never formally charged for any of this. And his lawyers also pointed out over the weekend that Child Protective Services the body that this report came from, are supposed to err on the side of believing kids in situations like this and that they're not a law enforcement body.
Well, it sounds like this caseworker was convinced this abuse happened. On KUOW's Facebook page, Leah asks us, why didn't they report it to law enforcement at the time?
So that's a good question. The case actually was reported to the police back in the 80s. The documents show that when Simpson originally reported this abuse, he was pretty adamant that the information stayed confidential between him and the caseworker that he talked to. But this caseworker was sort of felt like she had to pass it along, essentially. So she did contact the police and they got involved. They interviewed Simpson and they put together a case against both Murray and another foster parent that Simpson had named as an abuser, a previous foster parent. And the documents show that the police actually had two witnesses willing to testify in their case.
So why were charges never filed?
Well, the case went to the district attorney's office, which is where it would go after the police. Mm-hmm. And they apparently took it to a grand jury, which is this body that decides whether or not to formally charge somebody. And ultimately what happened was that the DA pulled the case from the grand jury before a decision was ever made, which is why we don't have formal charges and don't know whether or not he would have been formally charged under that body. The DA gave her reason in a letter. It said that she pulled the case because of Simpson's emotional instability, his history of manipulative behavior, and the fact that he'd actually run away and wasn't available to them. She says she wasn't sure whether they could meet the high burden of proof for a criminal case, essentially. And she finished her letter by saying that pulling the case in no way meant that her office had decided the allegations were not true. Mm-hmm. So there's all of that from those documents in 84. Now, Murray's team has come back and said that the fact that the DA withdrew the case at all shows there was too much doubt to go forward.
Right. And what's been the reaction from city council members to this?
We've seen a pretty strong reaction from one council member. Council member Lorena Gonzalez sent out a statement saying she wants the mayor to consider stepping down and that if he doesn't do that, she wants the council to basically convene its own committee to work out whether or not they think that should be the move. And she's given him a deadline of July 24th to make that decision. But at the council meeting this morning, we actually heard a pretty different message from council member Sally Bagshaw.
These are very serious charges. No question about that. But as a former prosecuting attorney, like Councilmember Gonzalez, we know that facts matter. And the allegations that are in the newspaper again yesterday, I want to just point out again that these are 30 years old. I hope that we can avoid grandstanding on this.
So that's Councilmember Sally Bagshaw, and she went on to say, as did most of the other council members, that she wants to weigh the options in this case. One of the things they talked about is there's a process for impeaching somebody in Murray's position. They would essentially have to sort of convene a court of the council, and he would be allowed to have legal representation in that sort of hearing. And they were saying they're not really sure if they could reach the bar needed as a council to take him out of office, even if they want to. So they're looking into essentially what are their options, what are their legal obligations, and convening with legal counsel, I believe, in the next couple of days, and just sort of looking at how to move forward. One other thing to note, and take this however you will, council member Bruce Harrell, who's the president of the council and who would replace Ed Murray if he resigns, mm-hmm. basically said in the meeting today, and he said it several times, that Murray continues to show up to do his job.
And what about the reaction from any of the candidates running to be the next mayor of Seattle? We just heard Jenny Durkin, our listeners may have heard her a few minutes ago, saying that she wants him to reflect, basically.
So we heard similar things from most of the front runners, right? You've got the six candidates who are sort of front runners, and most of them have called for Murray to either resign or consider resigning.
Reflect deeply about whether he could continue to lead, I think was the way Jenny Durkin put it.
Right. So we have heard similar calls from other candidates. Mike McGinn has been a little more outspoken and basically said it's time to step down. We're still waiting to hear. KUOW hasn't heard from Nikita Oliver or Bob Hasegawa in this case.
Finally, talking with KUOW reporter Kate Walters, what are the unanswered questions that we're left with and that you and KUOW newsroom are following?
Well, the big one is what we were just talking about. Whether or not Murray will actually resign is something that we're looking at. He said multiple times since this all started back in April that he won't. But he also said in the beginning that he wasn't going to stop his re-election campaign and ended up having to walk that back and pulling himself out of the running. So we don't really know where he's going to go with this. We also don't know whether or not this will prompt his one of his other accusers, Delvon Heckard, to refile his lawsuit against Murray sooner than he said he planned to.
Okay, that's what we know about these allegations and findings regarding Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray, and what we don't know as well, what we're pursuing. That's from our newsroom, KUOW reporter Kate Walters. Thanks a lot, Kate.
No worries.
Now, those are the allegations against the current mayor. We also want to help you figure out who ought to be the next mayor, and even if you're not in Seattle, it's just a fascinating drama and political and public process to watch these candidates try to make their case. And tonight, King 5's Natalie Brand and KUOW's Ross Reynolds will be with the six leading candidates for mayor on the stage at Impact Hub in Pioneer Square. You can hear it live on KUOW at 6:30 tonight. You can watch it live on King. And Ross Reynolds is here. He's been up since 3:30 in the morning working on this. Ross, good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you too, Bill.
So you get to ask in this debate, you get to ask the top candidates for mayor anything you want to ask. So what's on your mind?
Well, I'm very interested in hearing how they compare on the issues. You've been doing an excellent series of interviews. We just heard one with Jenny Durkin, but it's a little hard to compare them. Hopefully, we're going to attach the issues to them and you'll be able to see on stage where they differ. You know, we've been called a socialist hellhole by Fox News. We're certainly not the latter, and we're certainly not the former, but there is a certain connection of left liberal views from all these candidates. And so I'd like to see if we can drill down a little bit deeper so you can walk away going, yes, here's what this person says on affordable housing, and it's different from what this person says.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what I feel we need. I've been talking to these candidates serially, and just what you're saying, you kind of want to hear them talk to each other, too. That's key. So that's going to happen tonight. And have we heard from all the candidates yet? As I said, Jenny Durkin and I had an exchange. Kate Walters was telling us a little bit more about what candidates are saying. Is there anything you can pass on about the reaction to this Seattle Times story regarding Mayor Murray?
Well, as Kate mentioned, we've heard from a lot of the candidates, and we will hear from all of them this evening. I'd be very surprised if we didn't hear them speak out on this issue, one way or the other. Do they think the mayor should resign or not?
Yeah. And I hear that you are looking for newcomers to weigh in.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see what people outside our socialist hellhole think when they arrive here. So people who've been in Seattle for a couple of years or less, we'd love to hear your reactions to what's going on with our politics here. KUOW's social media producer, Bron Huberman, has a forum up on our website. So if you are a new arrival, go to KUOW.org/elections and fill out the form. We'd like to hear what you think.
I love that because sometimes I think KUOW reporters, we have such institutional knowledge. I wonder if sometimes if it's too much that we end up talking past people who have just come here and want to know what's the story.
Bill, we know too much.
We know too much. That's trouble. Ross Reynolds, thanks a lot for this.
You're welcome.
And tune in 6:30 tonight, and your ballot is coming to your mailbox. If you're a Seattleite and your ballot hasn't arrived already, you've either got it or about to, and you need to be sure to get that postmarked by August 1st. Back with the record in a moment. So when you hear that music, do you think musical theater? Well, the folks at Seattle Repertory Theater are hearing that. They've commissioned a new musical set in the 90s grunge scene with music from Alice in Chains and Soundgarden. One of my next guests says this is a guaranteed disaster. Sean Nelson is editor-at-large and arts writer for The Stranger and a rock and roll singer. Good to see you again.
Oh, good to see you as well.
Sean, why is a grunge musical a guaranteed disaster?
Well, I mean, I'm no theatrical impresario, but when I saw that they were planning to use the original song, you know, these songs, I guess like the one you were just playing, mm-hmm. I just thought, wow, this is a real opportunity to demonstrate how rock and roll and theater are incompatible.
Why incompatible?
I think primarily because whatever else you can say about rock and roll music, it is very dependent on the beat and volume and a certain kind of, not all of it is based on sort of screaming and abandon, but it definitely contains that component. Mm. And musical theater tends not to really favor that mode. And I think that it's just a, there are a lot of reasons why I think that is it's like a perfect mistake.
Well, why can't the Seattle rep bring the beat and the noise?
Because it is incompatible with the room. They could never make it loud enough in the room. I mean, they could physically make it loud enough in the room, but they certainly wouldn't. Uh-huh. Theaters tend to be at a more polite volume. They're designed for orchestral acoustics, I think, especially that one, which is a beautiful room. Mm-hmm. And they do lots of amazing work. I'm not trying to impugn the art form of musical theater. However, I do think that the idea of doing this is sort of a, you know, it clearly is a sort of tourist trap kind of model.
Ouch.
For art commissioning. And I think it would be a real drag. I think it would be a real disgrace, actually.
Like a disgrace. Okay, hold that thought. And let's bring in composer and musician Greta Harley. Greta, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
You were there for the 90s Seattle music scene. You work in theater now, and I understand you co-wrote your own grunge-sicle.
No, it was not a grunge.
Oh, okay. what should I call it?
Well, These Streets was a three-pronged artistic endeavor to bring the women into the story that was being formed by outsiders about what grunge was. Sean and I know each other a long time, and we certainly didn't use that term grunge.
Yes,
yeah, that's
was,
one of the surest signs.
It's a commodification. It's a term that was used to stamp a particular time period and a generation that I think was sardonic and sarcastic and yep. a bit xenophobic, and the immediate response to this, of course, in character of that, is like, this is going to be a disaster.
Yeah. I by the way, I thank you. When I'm speaking to the general audience, it's kind of like Pike's Market. I will use the term grunge because everybody right. knows what I'm talking about. But yes, that marks you as a Seattleite if you roll your eyes when you hear the word.
Well, I think it was in quotes for many years, air quotes.
It was. And I had to be talked out of I wanted to keep the quotes in when we started to promote These Streets, but again, I want to just go back to These Streets was not only about the theatrical piece, which was an unconventional format that had a live band, but we were focusing all of the music on the women, and we also had a portion of it that was conversations, public conversations, and art gallery pieces of the memorabilia. But we also had an art addendum to history, that the biographies of the women are now on the internet on thestreets.org. So we felt it was really important that it wasn't just the same handful of people that were making the story of the godfathers of grunge, that women actually were such a big part of that. And most people that I've talked to that weren't here have said to me, I didn't know women played music back then.
Right, right. Let me pick up on this idea of the being for the tourist, Sean, because you said that there's no way the Seattle Repertory Theater is going to create the sound of grunge, the noise, just the unholy sound. But what about what are you saying about it being for the tourists? Why can't a theater tell the story of a fascinating story? A story, you know, it's got the music, it's got the narrative. People know that there was a story that came out of Seattle at that time.
That's true, but the story has been amply documented. There's no shortage of versions of this story to be told. The only thing that's wrong with it, in my view, I mean, you know, if they want to do it, that's
yes.
great. It's fine. I'm not trying to say they mustn't do it.
Of course.
I'm just saying that it can't be good.
Yeah, because I want to get it. Like, it's what? It's cheesy. It's what? What is it that's going to be terrible in your opinion about this grunge music?
The very basic level, it will be a reduction of the experience, and in reducing it, simply in terms of the volume, it will diminish the thing itself and sort of make it into a T-shirt rather than this thing that actually happened and a sort of living, living is maybe the wrong word, but it is a scene and a time that actually did exist and it mattered, and to do a piece of art about it, I think, would be fantastic. I'd love it if somebody did that. Uh-huh. And to a certain extent, I think These Streets was a good example of somebody doing a show about a story that was in that time, but it wasn't the official story, and that's why it mattered. That's why it was important.
Well, there's no official story.
Right. There are official stories that have been handed down to, history and books and...
What's the unofficial garbage? I'm trying to get at what's like... So, Greta, doesn't all storytelling, theater, movies, it diminishes what actually happened. It's not a TikTok of what happened. What does they say? It's like a theater is life without the boring parts. What's wrong with condensing grunge into a little, evening experience for a couple hours? 90 minutes, whatever.
I think that whenever there is a time period and it has an impact to a broad range of people, that people are going to take that and create their own version of it, and it will be homogenized. It will be commodified, so it can't be exactly what we experience.
It never can be.
And there isn't one story. The only official story that's ever been told is by the same handful of people that have been interviewed about the same six or seven bands.
Yes,
right.
But there were hundreds and hundreds of bands, and thousands of people who went to these shows and created a very tight-knit community. And
so that's the only fidelity, is to tell a story of hundreds of bands?
No, I can see why. I think what Greta's saying is really true, but I can also see why you want to tell the story of the people who are famous and who really sort of made it out of Seattle, but there is something intrinsic to that time, as I understood it and experienced it, which is that it was the very process of being reduced by media, by MTV, by magazines, by people in Sheboygan that made the bands feel alienated from the very thing they were doing. And Seattle has always obviously had a very complicated relationship with fame and notoriety. Yep. And of course, there's a degree of wanting it, and it's unfashionable to admit you want it. But at the same time, when you get it, it is a nightmare that is still living for a lot of people.
Yes.
And I think that it is inevitable that if somebody's going to do the story of Seattle rock and roll, of that time, there's no way they're going to do it with a sad ending. There's no way they're going to do it with like this sort of, I guess that didn't work out so great. Good night, everybody. Thanks for coming.
Yes, the experience of it in Seattle, you're right, was absurd.
Yeah.
And but are we being too precious about what we really know happened when, for example, I think of grunge as being really theatrical, Jeremy spoke in class today there's this backstory about how he was bullied and daddy didn't give attention. The fact that mommy didn't care, King Jeremy, wicked.
Transformation that's happening right here.
But I'm saying if you're separate from being in the middle of it, and I saw them in somebody's basement in 1991 or whatever, if you just pull yourself back, isn't this theatrical music that ought to be made into a theater piece?
I don't know that the style that is, perhaps somebody could invent a brand new style of theatrical comportment that would allow for a stage vocalist to really scream the way he screams in that song, or the way Chris Cornell screams, or really any of the great vocal performances that happened in that music, the biggest hit songs, But I would be astonished if there was one living Broadway, like the best, most famous Broadway vocal performer who would be able to bring themselves to sing like that on stage, because it's not right. It's not correct singing.
I think that you know, one of the things that we, the challenges that we had when we produced These Streets is to have the music mixed like a live show. It didn't have the same kind of volume that you would get if you were at Mo. Mm-hmm. But it was, I think it was, it sounded pretty good. And we worked with somebody, Mike Soldano, and we had tube soakers, and we really had those guitars crunching, and they sounded great, and people were really singing out, and it wasn't mixed like the theater person wanted it to be mixed. And it was something that I had to really, work on with
you
him.
You had to fight for it.
We had to fight for it. And so I don't know what they're going to do with this. So it's right. for me, it's a little premature to have so much judgment on it.
Maybe Hamilton was a surprise.
And I think that, the David Byrne musical that they did was, people really seemed to love it.
Here Lies Love about Imelda Marcos. That was a crazy idea.
Yeah. And so maybe, maybe they'll all surprise us, but I hope that they will do their research properly. And I hope that they will honor the music in a way that it deserves to be honored, and that the stories are listened to in an authentic way.
Okay, there's tip one, Seattle Rep. Please honor the music. Sean Nelson, any final advice? If Seattle Rep is listening to this right now, what should they do if they want to make it successful? They're going to make it, Sean.
I don't know. I mean, I hasten to recall the old commercial for the classic rock compilation. I can't even remember what it's called. I just remember that it ended with a hippie in a chair outside of a Winnebago saying, "Turn it up, man."
Turn it up, Seattle Rep.
It has to be uncomfortably loud and, sung incorrectly.
And that won't happen.
It won't happen.
Do it loud, do it wrong. Sean Nelson, editor at large, writes about the arts for The Stranger. Greta Harley, co-writer of the musical These Streets, A Rock and Roll Story. Check it out. Both of you, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the Seattle Rep's idea of a quote-unquote, air quotes, grunge musical. Back with more of KUW's The Record in a moment. KUW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Be careful what you put in an email, or you might get caught telling someone, "I love it," especially later in the summer, which was Donald Trump Jr.'s reply to an email about the Russian government wanting to help his dad become president. Well, how should you use email? And what should you use instead of email? That's what we're going to discuss right now. My first guest, New York Times tech columnist Farhad Manju, who thinks email's days are numbered. Welcome, Farhad.
Hey, good to be here.
You hate email. Why is that?
I mean, do we have enough time for me to list the ways? It's awful. I think everyone knows, what's terrible about email. It's sort of this like daily horror awaiting you every morning.
Just because it fills your inbox or something else?
Yeah, it's this sort of tidal wave of messages from people you don't know usually wanting a response. It's open to the whole world. So sort of anyone can get at you at that address. The tools to use it have gotten better. I mean, Gmail is like way better than, the earlier tools that we had. You can now search, but the problem with email is that it's sort of overstuffed. We use it for communication. We use it for transactions. We use it for receipts. We use it for like calendaring and to-do lists. And so it's this one tool that becomes this kind of generic place for everything, which leads to both, the inconvenience of it, the like complexity and the feeling of dread we have when dealing with it, but also makes it this huge security threat. The kind of many of the major security, cybersecurity incidents you can think of in the past few years were initially caused by people clicking the wrong link in an email. That's kind of one of the major ways that, computers get hacked.
Well, maybe Donald Trump Jr.'s affair with email will strike one blow against the form. What was your reaction to the Trump Jr.? I love it, especially later in the summer. Here's all my email story.
Yeah, I mean, so the Trump Jr., the irony, of course, is that we're talking about emails with regard to the Trump campaign when we spent much of 2016 talking about emails with regard to the Clinton campaign. Mm-hmm. And both those incidents to me suggest that I think, more sophisticated political campaigns, businesses certainly, and basically anyone else that has to manage sensitive information is almost certainly, you know, looking into or probably already moving to think to just communication channels that are better in various ways. But you know, the primary way is being more secure. There are lots of different systems that allow end-to-end encryption, which means that people can't look at your communication along the way, that allow messages to sort of expire, so they like auto-delete, kind of like Snapchat does, and various other kind of built-in security features that, you know, make them not unhackable, but sort of more protected than email is.
Okay, hang on a second, Farhad. Also with us is writer Amy Webb, who thinks about the future of email at the Future Today Institute. She also wrote a book called The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Amy, welcome to KUOW.
Hey there.
So Farhad was talking about better communication channels, but you've called email a necessary evil. What do you mean by that?
Well, so my job, so I'm a futurist, and my job is to sort of think through the implications, the coming implications of emerging technology. And, you know, we're in a transition period with regards to a lot of different technologies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are apps that exist now. There's Signal. There are other ways to send content. There's even a supposedly encrypted email system called ProtonMail. But the reality is that, you know, the vast majority of people don't think about security and don't demand encryption until they've personally had cause to, because they've suffered a breach. So, you know, I hate email. I hate looking at my inbox, and I've done everything I can internally at my company to get off of email. But the fact is, we still have to, like, I still have to, you know, send my dad pictures of my kid. you know, and I have to, like, talk to our accountants. And so, you know, for the moment, we're shackled to this system. So the best that we could possibly hope for is that everybody develops a better sense of street smarts, digital street smarts in the near term.
Street smarts. You know, that what has struck me about the Donald Trump Jr. affair is how many people are saying, oh, you fool, you said something that you believed. And you got caught because it's not private enough. I mean, is the point, is the idea to become more and more secretive as a society?
Well, you know, the thing that I found so fascinating about the whole incident is that, you know, here are a group of people who are younger, right? And we would ascribe to them certain digital street smarts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And somehow not only did it apparently not occur to them not to put that type of information into a written form, right, that's archived. But also, once you forward a message, like, the whole string goes with it.
Yeah, how about that?
You know, and so, again, but to me, you know, it's a separate conversation for another day about our current administration's understanding of technology. But it's a good reminder that, you know, regardless of your age, you know, everyday people struggle with how information moves around. And that was just the text that we saw. There's hidden information in that message, too, like the metadata showing where the, you know, how the message moved around and when it was sent and on what type of machine. There's a lot more that went with that message than just the text that we all saw.
Farhad Manju from The New York Times, a tech columnist there, feels like almost all of us use email. Is there going to be a future technology that we're virtually all going to use that's different?
No, I think what will happen is sort of what happens every time you get a new technology, which is we still use the old thing and we use the new thing also. I agree with Amy. The reason that we all use email is because sort of everyone else uses email. It's like this universal way of getting at essentially anybody.
Yep.
And it's also, you know, the kind of accepted social way. So if I send you an email out of the blue asking you something, it's not considered rude, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think we're seeing sort of some parts of email being disrupted by other tools. So, you know, one of the more successful startups recently is called Slack, and it's an interoffice chat system.
Yeah, we use it here in our newsroom.
Yeah, and we use it at the New York Times. And I've noticed that, you know, while not everyone is using it, probably, you know, some significant percentage of communication that used to happen over email is now happening over Slack. So email is sort of, there's a reduced burden on email.
But is Slack private? Is what I write on Slack, will that come back to me?
It could come back to you. I mean, Slack, like email, is legally discoverable. So okay. If you're in a lawsuit.
All right. Amy, I heard you wanting to talk too.
Go ahead. Yeah, Farhad, you finish up and then I've got a funny story to share.
Okay.
I was just going to say, so I think, you know, one of the things that may end up happening is that some parts of what we use email for now, like I no longer look at email for my flight, my itineraries, because like they show up in the United app that I use. So like those kinds of things, you know, may move to apps, may move to, you know, different kinds of services. And so I think the reliance on email may just go down over time.
Amy, we have a minute and a half left here at the end of the show for a story about Slack or whatever what you want to tell.
Sure. So we, you know, like many companies, we only use Slack internally. We don't email at all. The government attempted to do that as well. And one of the things that folks discovered pretty early on was that if you had, you know, it became not difficult to see all of the government's, all of the State Department Slack channels. And I think that, again, what this points to is we all have this, and it is a funny story, maybe not funny, ha-ha, but I think what this points to is humans, technology moves fast, but we humans don't typically move fast to catch up with it. And so, you know, Slack is now a verb, but email has been a verb for a really long time. And until you have a critical mass of people, you know, it sort of at this point doesn't matter what platform you use, everybody understands the basic gist of an email. Until we have a critical mass of people who feel comfortable messaging in a different way that can also send attachments and it's not complicated and it fulfills all of the same needs and desires and requirements that we have for email, in effect, until we have another verb, right? Mm-hmm. I think we're stuck with email, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future. And I believe that State has gone back to using more email and less Slack.
Amy Webb, founder of the Future Today Institute and author of The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. And Farhad Manju is tech columnist for The New York Times. Great to talk to both of you. Thank you for this.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
We're just over the telephone. We'd like to hear from you on this, KOW listener. Are you living in a post-email world or just dreaming about it? From Twitter, I see that SB Hopper tweets to us, email, still great for transactional data, count to 100 before sending. Thank you. Good advice on Twitter at KOW. Let us know what you're doing instead of email if you've got a better idea. Go to KOW's Facebook page or leave us a voicemail, 221-3663.